Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. Alice Chen, Chief Medical Officer for the San Francisco Health Network and Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and your moderator for tonight's program, The Impact of the Affordable Care Act on Women, generously underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. Almost exactly 5 years ago, the Affordable Care Act was signed into law, heralded as the most sweeping change in the U.S. healthcare system since the 1965 passage of Medicare and Medicaid. The law has been unfolding in stages. On January 1, 2014, many of the law's key provisions took effect, including expansion of health coverage and free access to preventive health services for 47 million American women. So a year later, we're here to assess how successful has the rollout of Obamacare been? What changes have Americans experienced in their health care? And in particular, has the ACA lived up to its promise for providing more accessible, higher quality care for women? Tonight, we're fortunate to have a panel of healthcare experts to discuss the impact of the Affordable Care Act as it relates to women. So here on my right, Dr. Claire Brindis, Director of the UCSF Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies. We also have Carlina Hansen, Executive Director of the Women's Community Clinic in San Francisco, and Lupe Rodriguez, Director of Public Affairs for Planned Parenthood, Marmonte. Please join me in welcoming our panelists to the Commonwealth Club. All right. So before we begin our discussion about the impact of the ACA on women, I wanted to provide a very brief review for our audience about the major provisions of the ACA to frame our discussion. So it's almost 1,000 pages in length, and therefore it contains many different provisions. However, many would say that the main provisions are twofold. So first, to decrease the number of uninsured Americans. And second, to make the insurance market more fair, transparent, and affordable to consumers. At the same time, it has a myriad of other goals, including improving quality of care and patient experience, promoting care coordination, targeting runaway healthcare costs, and investing in public health, among many others. I suspect a lot of these issues will be highlighted by our panelists this evening. So in order to understand the impact of ACA on women, it's important to understand where we stood prior to the ACA. So I'd like to start by asking each of our panelists to highlight what they see as, this is maybe a little extreme, but the most egregious problem facing women's healthcare prior to the passage and implementation of ACA.
Well, I'll start, Alice. Yeah. Thank you very much, and also thank you to the Commonwealth Club for having this important panel, because there's been so much myth information about the ACA, but I think that one of the major issues really had to do with the unevenness, inequality of the playing field for women, given that so many women had lack of access to affordable health care. Before the ACA, about 1 in 4 women had no access to health insurance, and among those who did have access, many of them did not have the types of services available to them that really benefit and are aimed at helping them actualize their best health and wellness. I'm sure you have many others to add.
Yeah, I think there's a great many things, certainly, and I would add to what Claire had to say about the inequity of the playing field. I think one of the biggest things prior to the Affordable Care Act for women was the fact that women paid so much more for their health insurance. On average, women paid about $1 billion more than men per year in coverage, called gender rating. There was also a massive exclusion of things like pregnancy benefits. And I think I can pretty safely say that everyone in the room came from a womb. So to me, that's something that we as a society really should be sharing in the cost of. And those are just two of many examples.
I'll add that one of the things that was missing before was coverage for contraceptives. So, you know, going with pregnancy care, cost of contraceptives was, you know, different for different plans that people had if they were lucky enough to have insurance. As was mentioned, women had to pay more because of, you know, the sort of extra costs of being a woman, extra medical costs, as they put it. I think there's also something to say about the inequities that existed and that still exist in some ways for women of color and low-income women. Women of color were many times more likely to be uninsured than other women, particularly Latina women had the highest rates of uninsured in the state of California. 38% of Latinas were uninsured before the ACA. And that number has been greatly reduced. I think 4 million Latinas have now, now qualify for some level of coverage, either through the health insurance exchange or through Medi-Cal, which is the state Medicaid program here in California. And so I think that that's one thing that has changed a lot. Again, not just between sort of women and men, but between women of color and, higher income white women specifically.
I think additionally, I think we should think about tonight not just the impact on women's health for themselves, but also the very vital role that women play in their families in terms of care coordination, in terms of being the sandwich generation, and the level of fragmentation and the level of lack of investment in prevention, the lack of medical homes for individuals, often placed even an additional burden on women that really impacted their own health, but also made balancing work and life and family even harder and made it much more complicated for them to be able to do what they want to do for their families, which is really help to broker information, help to assure that there's access to care. So having systems that Alice is referring to that begin to change where we put the emphasis also places or lift some of the load on women.
Yeah, and I think we'll get back to this idea that a woman kind of being at the core and managing healthcare for many members of the family, their kids, themselves, their partner, oftentimes their parents. In fact, at ThetaCare, which is an integrated delivery system in Wisconsin, they've kind of boiled it down to kind of the prototypical consumer, and it's Lori, who's a 40-year-old woman with two kids and parents, you know, because actually prototypically it is the woman who actually holds it together. Mm-hmm. I want to delve a little bit, though, into some of the things you raised. We talked about access. We talked about the gender disparity, impact of on women of color. And so I would say by one measure, one of the real successes of the ACA, one of the areas that's gotten a lot of publicity is insurance reform. So issues like insurance companies can no longer deny insurance based on pre-existing conditions, annual and lifetime limits, insurance premiums are standardized. We've talked a little bit about the gender rating disparity, which I think is probably shocking to people, the $1 billion number that you mentioned. Can you talk a little bit more about how these insurance reforms have benefited women more specifically?
Well, I'll start again, but the concept of pre-existing conditions that you just referred to, I'll just take that one as an example. And so even having a pregnancy or having a chronic health condition such as diabetes or a cardiovascular disease would be enough of an excuse for an insurance company to say, I don't want to cover this life. And so as women began to try to struggle with, okay, we know that insurance is a very important passport for finding a provider of choice. Without that coverage and with having a condition such as even a mental health issue, which we know affects women disproportionately, they too were hindered from seeking health care.
Yeah, at the Women's Community Clinic prior to the Affordable Care Act, we saw uninsured women pretty much exclusively. So the onset of the Affordable Care Act has had a tremendous impact on our clients in a wide variety of ways. The majority of these women have become eligible for care. And when we talk about the reforms, I always think about the stories or the changing stories of the women who are coming into our clinic and what those really look like. One of our clients was charged $6,000 upon going to an emergency room out of county for a urinary tract infection. This was someone who struggled to pay for her BART fare every day to get into work. I think we have to talk about the fact that lack of insurance was one of the leading causes of bankruptcy in the United States. So there's story after story like that. women who've been denied coverage, as Claire said, for being a victim of domestic violence. Women could be denied coverage for that. So imagine being victimized in that terrible way and then turning around and becoming a victim to the system. And those are egregious stories, but there are many more that are sort of the routine day to day. And I think what we saw at the clinic before the ACA was how much the norm the lack of coverage had become and how deep and universal that was to our patients. And happily I can say that that's really starting to shift.
Yeah, and I'll add that, you know, besides obviously the fact that our levels of folks who are uninsured has decreased, I think some very specific provisions in the ACA that have benefited women are the provision that makes it so that health insurance plans have to cover contraceptives without co-payments, that many preventative health services like breastfeeding counseling and, you know, well women exams and annual exams and things like that are also offered without co-pay. So a lot of that sort of emphasis and provisions that were put into the ACA about prevention and you know, ensuring that insurance plans give those benefits and services to women beneficiaries without having to pay a copay has been a really great and important part of the change for women. I think, you know, speaking to that, at many community clinics like Planned Parenthood and others, exactly the same, that we've gone from seeing folks who, you know, had no kind of insurance, no kind of coverage, to folks who now have something and can receive a breadth of services. So no longer just interventions for reproductive health care or contraceptives, but now, you know, primary care and other kinds of care that they weren't able to receive before. A lot of women sort of receive their first entry into medical care through, you know, going to see, getting a pap smear or getting a pregnancy test. So that has changed greatly because of the ACA.
And talking about safety net providers, places like community health centers, public clinics, family planning clinics like Planned Parenthood, they have played such a critical role in ensuring access for women. This is one of the questions from our audience. Some argue that because the ACA expanded coverage and theoretically access to healthcare providers for millions, there's no longer a need for community clinics. Mm-hmm. True, false, how and why?
Very much false. Yes. I think one of the biggest things is that you not only have to have the insurance, you have to have somewhere you can go to use the insurance, mm-hmm. right? And the challenge in California is, and I'll let Lupe expand on this more because I know that she knows a lot about it, is that our Medi-Cal reimbursement rates are so incredibly low. And so we're not pulling private physicians and doctors into the network and practices because it's really just challenging for people to deliver care. Thankfully, community clinics, Planned Parenthood's women's community clinics, public health clinics are supported in a variety of different kinds of ways that enable us to do that. And that's something that we're extremely committed to doing, is continuing to see poor women who need access to health care. And Lupe, I'm sure you have things you want to add on the Medi-Cal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you know, just starting again with the question of why community clinics are still very important, I think in addition to the fact that we are everywhere, and we were there before the ACA providing this care to people. I think that continuity of care has been really, really important for people. And I think that we're integral in continuing to provide that care and expanding our services with the support of the ACA to be able to, you know, to be medical homes and provide care for people in their communities. But yeah, you know, with the issue of Medi-Cal reimbursement rates, many organizations like ours see patients who are the poorest of the poor, who are beneficiaries in the Medi-Cal program. And you know, the rates for Medi-Cal, for many of the services provided through Medi-Cal were set in the 80s, so 1985 for many services. And so if you can imagine, you know, the cost of living now and the cost of providing care for people 30 years later is completely changed, but the rates have not sort of moved with the times and had not increased. And in fact, in 2008 and 2009, when the state was facing, you know, really severe budget cuts and severe, you know, cuts to programs, the Medi-Cal program received an additional 10% cut to the existing 1980 reimbursement rates. So, you know, that sort of paints a picture. It's even less than what we were paid in the 80s. And that kind of thing has been very challenging for community health centers like Planned Parenthood and others who see these patients, Medi-Cal patients, a new influx of over 12 million Medi-Cal patients in the state of California who need someplace to go, but you know, often can't find providers in their communities because you know a lot of providers aren't able to sustain providing services with the cost of you know what we're getting reimbursed. So
what's interesting about what you just said is sort of that is the cup half empty or half full, because in some regards we're so fortunate in California to have the types of services that we've just been talking about. But there are many states in the country that have not expanded access to Medicaid at all. And so the lowest income populations, often ethnically diverse populations, have even worse access to health care, particularly in the southern part of the United States. And I know that our listening audience is not only in California, but from across the country. So we need to recognize that the growing pains of having a state like California that has been progressive to open up its doors to Medicaid, we are going through some growing pains, and it's going to take a while to shift the sands for us to catch up, but and also to overcome the inequalities that were built and you know baked into the DNA of the Medicaid program when it didn't really have the kinds of reimbursement that doctors and nurse practitioners and physicians associates really need. Yeah. So I think it's a complex picture that we're drawing for the audience and trying to figure out how to best move that agenda forward.
I do want to stay on this issue of Medicaid, and from our questions from the audience, it does seem like we have a fairly sophisticated group, and everyone here probably knows that Medi-Cal is California's Medicaid program. But I wanted to dig both at a high-level policy level and then kind of more on-the-ground implementation. As a doctor, I'm a primary care doc who works in the safety net. If I were only allowed to celebrate one aspect of ACA, it would be Medicaid expansion, actually. But the problem is, as of last month, I think 17 states had opted not to expand Medicaid, even though the federal government's going to fit foot between 90 to 100% of the bill.
Yeah.
So can you describe what this expansion entails and what the impact of not expanding Medicaid is? I mean, right here in California, as you highlighted, we are fortunate. But let's talk about those people, and then let's come back to California.
Well, I'll start and just say that it's really hard and complex for me as to, I can't understand why these states are not expanding, because to me, having a healthy working population and having even a low-income population that may not have access to jobs, we all carry that burden of responsibility, whether you're a man or a woman who needs health care, and yet because you don't have health insurance, you don't seek care, or you have something called foregone care. So you wait until much later to enter the healthcare system because you don't have that kind of coverage. So we all end up, and particularly in those states, end up paying for healthcare at a much higher level than you would if you had these kinds of systems in place that would allow or enable women and men to enter the healthcare system and children entering the healthcare system through the kinds of networks that are represented on this panel. So in some regards, I think it's cutting your nose to spite your face. But again, difficult arguments when it's seen as sort of an Obamacare, a political kind of force that is sort of denying that one has responsibility, social will and social responsibility for your state's health status.
I mean, I don't think I have too much more to add. I mean, I think it's very sad to me as well, and I think there is no real palatable or understandable reason other than the fact that it is political, right? There's 100% payment from the federal government in the initial years of the rollout of the Affordable Care Act to the states for their expansion. 100%. So the cost is really a great benefit to the state. And the states that are participating also have the potential that they have to pay in a multitude of ways for the states that are not expanding. So it really has a national impact. And then, of course, and I'm sure this question is going to come up, we're looking at King versus Burwell, which is challenging a key provision of the ACA that has the potential to impact the individuals in the states that have not elected to expand Medicaid or not participate in the exchange. Actually, that's specifically around the exchange. But those folks could fall off coverage. And there's a lot of overlap between those states. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's very, very frightening prospect if you know, the decision comes on the side of removing those subsidies for people in those states. that are challenging the subsidies for you know buying insurance through the exchange. But I think you know I'll add that the Medicaid expansion in other states is and the lack of that is actually very problematic because 1/3 of women in throughout the country are under or below 200% of the federal poverty level, which is you know in lay terms $40,000 a year for a family of three, which you know isn't a lot of money. And these same folks, if they're not eligible for Medicaid because they don't have that expansion in their state, may not also be able to afford to buy insurance through the exchange. So essentially, you're creating a space where folks are still unable to be covered and are unable to receive coverage. And so I think that that's a really important thing to remember, that very many people in this country, over 30%, are you know really, really low income in that 200% of federal poverty. And you know, would benefit greatly from this coverage, but are being denied that because as was said, no, the politics in their states are not allowing that to happen.
So talking about politics, since actually we all know that the reason not all states have expanded Medicaid is because of the first Supreme Court decision, allowing states to kind of make that decision rather than more or less being required to, dependent on all their funding. We now have another Supreme Court case, which you had kind of alluded to in passing. Can someone explain to the audience what the issues at stake here are? And do you have any prognostications, perhaps, about what the Supreme Court may decide?
Well, I think as Lupe started to share, part of the success of the ACA, I mean, we have to have as many healthy bodies covered by health insurance to offset the costs for those individuals who are ill. And so if we don't give premiums, the whole case is really around, should states that have a federally supported program rather than a state-run program for their exchange no longer be receiving the kinds of subsidized premiums for those individuals who qualify, who are don't qualify for Medicaid because they make over that 133% of poverty level, but qualify up to 400% of poverty. And so it's really one of those nuances in the law that's a state provision versus federal provision. And it's almost to me like another element of the political game of trying to tear down the architecture of the ACA. And I do appreciate the fact that it is a very controversial piece of legislation. It is revolutionary, as you mentioned earlier. But I want to remind people that in the mid-60s under President Johnson, when Medicaid and Medicare were first introduced to our country, initially very few states signed up. And it took a while for this kind of social movement to take hold and to have traction. So I'm not surprised that there's still huge numbers of detractors and pockets across our country and in Congress that are saying, let's eliminate this. And yet, what are the viable alternatives for coverage? I will say this, that I think it's very immoral that in this country, before the ACA, we had approximately between 45 to 55 million Americans without health insurance coverage. And to me, what could be more moral than giving individuals access to the health care that they need?
Yeah, I think I'll add, and I want to clarify that I did conflate two issues earlier on. There are the states that have decided not to expand Medicaid, and then there are the states that, which is under dispute in King versus Burwell, which have decided not, excuse me, to provide their own exchanges and to rely on the federal exchange. And that's really the piece that's under question. I would reinforce what Claire said. I think it's politics. It's a peccune sort of piece of the law that people are targeting to undermine the ACA, in my opinion. And I wish I had a crystal ball to say what the Supreme Court, but that might be above my pay grade. So, But my hope is that the courts see that it wouldn't have been the intention of the law to undermine itself, really. If it were ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, 7.5 million individuals would fall off of coverage. I think the other thing that would happen is they talk about the death spiral. of insurance coverage. With people falling off, premiums would rise and more people would fall off. So it sort of creates this cascading effect. The other thing specifically to say about women in the exchange is that it disproportionately does impact women because 55% of the people who have enrolled in the exchange are women. So women have enrolled at a higher proportion. So I sincerely hope they don't rule in favor of the plaintiffs, but we'll see.
Can you guys actually describe, I'm not sure how many people here have had experience, direct experience with Covered California, which is our state's exchange, or among our listeners, healthcare.gov. Could you guys just describe the structure of the exchanges and what they're meant to accomplish? Some people have said that prior to the health exchanges, shopping for individual insurance was like shopping for a car before you had the internet. You know, a lot of footwork, really difficult to compare things. It's meant to be one-stop shopping. How does it work?
Do you want to reverse, Lupe?
Sure. So as many of you know, Covered California was created by the Department of Healthcare Services and a board. And it's a marketplace hosted online for the most part, but there are organizations across the state that have gone out into the community to do enrollment and education about the process and actually facilitate the process for many people to enroll. And so it's a place where people can look at different plans with different coverage options and sort of figure out what might work best for them in their situation in their life. And a rating where you know, in the state of California, specifically for Covered California, there are basic sort of levels of care that have to be provided by plans. And that's a really important part and difference in what, you know, how it was before for people buying plans, where there were a lot of sort of hidden clauses about, you know, pregnancy care and other types of services. So again, there's sort of a standard of care that Covered California has provided, or a standard of coverage for every plan. And it's, again, a marketplace where people can go, find what's best for them, and also, very importantly, find whether or not they qualify for a subsidy from the federal government through their, you know, tax breaks to be able to pay for the insurance. And so, for, you know, it's a very sort of important part of it, because that's a key piece of affordability for coverage that, you know, and before, a lot of people didn't have access to that, didn't have access to, or the means to be able to pay for a plan for themselves. And so this has been a really important part of Covered California and the exchange as a whole.
Right. And what if...
That's my comment, that I think we need to understand the level of low healthcare literacy among a large number of our population, and that this is complex. And a large part of this one-stop shopping is to try to break down what are some of those options. There are 10 essential benefits, but there are many different ways. There are different providers and different networks, and so trying to really begin to educate individuals around what does a premium mean? What are the costs associated with it? What are your rights under health insurance? What will it cost for you? What happens if you lose your employment benefits? What if, you know, if you're a dependent trying to get coverage for your whole family or get coverage for yourself? So I think you need to understand that these are not common words and common language, and that we don't have, you know, we haven't had TV shows that bring in actors and actresses who talk about premiums. You know, it's not sexy to sell it. So in a way, the internet and the ability to have the one-stop shop begins to break down some of this unknown information. Mm-hmm. But it still takes time. And again, I think that there were many people who delayed entering and going for the exchange, and there had to be a lot of publicity. One of the areas that I'm most concerned about are young adult coverage. And it turned out to be that mothers were the most influential factor in getting their sons to sign up for health insurance. And the Young Invincibles, who is a group that cares deeply about the young adult population, because a third of the young adults were not covered before the ACA, they had a campaign around the first enrollment. It was the day after Valentine's Day. So they called it Friends with Benefits. So if you could really get a friend to sign up and help to educate the young adult about why health insurance is even important.
Right. Speaking of Friends with Benefits, my hope is that one day people will look back in puzzlement at our pre-ACA era when contraceptives were considered a lifestyle drug. You know, I still remember, I don't know if you guys remember when some insurance companies were covering Viagra, but not contraceptives. Can you guys talk a little bit more about this idea of first, this is the jargon part, first dollar coverage of preventive health services and how that really benefits women?
I think from a from the perspective of contraception, to use your specific example, and all the preventive benefits that are named under the ACA, women can actually walk in the door and access care without any cost sharing, right? It's what they say about an ounce of prevention. And it really does go a long way. People can come and they don't have to be afraid that because they're going to access something that should be commonplace, that they are going to get, again, a big bill. Obviously, we also know the benefits of contraceptives in preventing pregnancy, reducing cost to the healthcare system, allowing women to make choices about when they want to be pregnant, fantastic methods like long-acting reversible contraceptives, which previously were far too expensive for a lot of women, are now more readily available. And I think, you know, that's just one of the many preventive benefits that we see. Also, another is mammograms. And uninsured women were far more likely to die prematurely from breast cancer than insured women were. So that's a huge shift. And the list really goes on and on.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'll add that, as I mentioned earlier, Well Women exam, so your annual exam is now covered as a preventative service, and various other, as I've said, breastfeeding counseling, domestic violence intervention, interventions and that kind of thing are also covered without a share of cost or co-payment. And so I think those things have really changed the landscape for women in terms of having access to services without having to worry about coming up with that $5, $10, $15, $20 to pay, which, as mentioned, you know, is often or can be a huge barrier for people accessing care when you know, that might be food money or transportation money. And I think I'll also say that one of the things that we've seen in the rollout of the ACA was that even though, you know, these benefits, particularly contraception, was a part of the formulary of services that were offered, sometimes, you know, the types of contraceptives were limited for women. And one of the things that California has done, and thankfully, is this past year passed a law that will now make it so that every insurance plan in the state has to offer every FDA-approved contraceptive on their formulary. So that, again, will increase women's access to things like long-acting reversible contraceptives, which are more expensive than the pill, say, but are definitely more effective and you know, give women a lot more sort of freedom and options. So I think that that's a really important part of the sort of evolving implementation of the ACA and how we, you know, the bills that are being passed in California specifically to ensure that people have very equitable coverage across, you know, across whatever sort of insurance they have.
Right. So speaking of equitable coverage and also more jargon, this idea of essential benefits. I think probably most Americans didn't realize that maternity and newborn coverage wasn't considered an essential benefit and that more than 50% of individual plans actually didn't cover it at all. Can you talk a little bit more about what is in that package besides now maternal and newborn care?
Well, maternity care is definitely a very big factor, given that many, many women do decide to have children at some point in their lives, and they or their partners end up paying for a large proportion of it. But also mental health services, outpatient, hospital services, some of the prescription drug services are part of this essential benefit package. And what I want to indicate also here in terms of these essential benefits, someone has said to me, well, why should I pay for some, I'm a man, why should I pay for other people's maternity leave? And the reality, or maternity care, and the reality is that, you know, biologically, it's not the fault of women that they're the only ones who can bear children. And oftentimes, you know, and the reality is that we want to spread the cost of these services that are common and that really are essential in terms of improving the health and well-being and the outcomes of these pregnancies. Because if a baby is born prematurely or because there's not enough prenatal care, because there's disincentives to use the system appropriately, the whole health insurance company and the beneficiaries, including ourselves, end up footing the bill. So we all should think about how invested we should be in each other's well-being and each other's healthy outcomes. And a note I want to make about these preventive services that we were just talking about and focusing on contraceptives, I do also want to acknowledge that we're not just talking about women in their young adulthood and adulthood up to age of 64. There's also prevention that's been incorporated into the Medicare program that hadn't been there. So a wellness visit, osteoporosis screening, a variety of services that had not also been included for our more elder populations who themselves will end up bearing a lot of cost if they don't have these kinds of coverages. And I don't know if you want to add any more around essential benefits and how you've seen that affecting
you. I think one of the important things that you kind of indicated, Claire, is the awareness of the benefits that are in the package. I think these amazing benefits are there, and we really need to encourage our patients, our friends, the new consumers of healthcare to engage these things and use them. It's, you know, if you haven't been insured, if you've gone from being uninsured to being uninsured, it's like a still very difficult to wrap your head around, even though this is highly simplified from what it used to be. And so I think as healthcare providers, building that awareness, making sure that people are accessing those preventive services, that people are accessing their healthcare, re-enrolling in it, making sure they stay on their healthcare. Those are kind of some of the next things we need to be thinking about to make sure that that literacy goes up, people understand their plans, they understand the costs, they understand the subsidies that are available to them, and they really can be in charge of their healthcare. I think one of the things in this country is there's so much employer-based care, and that's really so embedded in our system. And in many ways, that's been extremely beneficial. But there's also been some challenges with that, and that it's made the cost of care and what insurance means largely invisible to the consumer. And so it's kind of on us now to become more knowledgeable consumers and use this exciting care.
I'd just add quickly that I think for all of the new sort of benefits that we have in prevention, I think it's very important to remember that individuals, depending on who they're employed by, may not have access to contraceptives or other, you know, benefits that, or services that their employer might not want to cover. As many of you know, there have been challenges to those provisions in the ACA around contraception specifically, where places like Hobby Lobby, for example, don't want to cover that because they have sort of moral, they want to have a moral exemption. So I think it's very important to highlight that you know, there have been challenges and setbacks in that. And that also, you know, we still have a huge population of over 11 million undocumented immigrants in the state, or in the country, I should say, who don't have coverage and who were sort of explicitly excluded from the ACA. So I think that's also, I don't know, we've mentioned it before, but I think that's an important point to make right now.
The only exception in California has been for the deferred action for childhood
That's
arrivals,
right.
The DACAs, sometimes known as the Dreamers. Because they're now being eligible for at least a couple of years of coverage, and maybe hopefully longer, in California there has been a real effort to assure access to this population. And they have a variety of mental health needs and also physical health needs that have not been responded to in the past. So it is an exception to be living in a state like our own. Mm-hmm. There are only a few other handful of states right. that allow that to happen.
And you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight's discussion is the impact of the Affordable Care Act on women, underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. Our panelists are Dr. Claire Brindis, director of the UCSF Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies, Carlina Hansen, executive director of the Women's Community Clinic in San Francisco, and Lupe Rodriguez, director of public affairs for Planned Parenthood, Marmonte. I'm Dr. Alice Chen, chief medical officer for the San Francisco Health Network, and your moderator for tonight's program. I'm just going to shift to one of the questions from our audience, which is about what needs to happen surrounding child care at the workplace. And I think this gets to the Kaiser Family Foundation survey that was done in 2013 on women's health. One out of four respondents reported that lack of time was a barrier to getting care, and that included child care, things that they had to do at home, sick time policies. How do we actually ensure that women can transition back to their careers and access healthcare and take care of their families? What are some of the things that we need to do?
Well,
big question.
It's an easy, short list.
We talk about wage equity. I think we need to address some of these issues very specifically in public policy. So we need to look at what we can do to improve access to childcare, what we can do to improve access to transportation for individuals. That is a huge barrier for poor women who often have to take 5-6 buses to get to their care. And what we can do as providers to improve that access and better coordinate care. So, you know, when people come to our clinic, we look at giving them, you know, cab vouchers, bus passes to make sure that they can get to their next visits. And I think also some of the great work that Planned Parenthood is doing around telehealth and creating access online, whether it be to birth control or other healthcare services, I think is a really exciting access point for women who have families who may just realistically be too busy to get out of the house, as the statistics have shown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll add that I think in rural California, that's an especially big problem with lack of infrastructure in terms of access to services, or in transportation, but also the lack of providers who are in those areas to serve those communities. And so I think that's an issue that we have to address. But I'll actually, throw out what you started to mention about wage equity and living wage and just sort of addressing poverty in general for many of these communities. I think some of the sort of what I sort of surmise is behind some of this issue of people not being able to, even if they have insurance, not being able to sort of get over the other barriers that exist in their lives to get the healthcare they need, have a lot to do with, having to work two to three jobs to make ends meet, having no childcare, not having money to be able to pay for childcare. So there's a lot of sort of practical issues that have to do a lot with socioeconomic status and with poverty that I think need to be addressed in order to be able to address the sort of larger picture of health outcomes and access for a lot of communities.
I think one of the policy issues that overlaps with health is a lack of sick days coverage by the employers. So many women, over 80% of employees, don't have any kind of sick day coverage. And so they have to play the role of Solomon in deciding, do you go to work? Do you put your sick child on the bus that might then give colds, a flu, other illnesses to other children in that school classroom? And the sort of having to decide, am I able to take off any time? And if I take time off, what does that mean to my paycheck? I think we need to think about how short-sighted the lack of some of this social support means, because we know that healthcare goes far beyond just being able to access and come into a wonderful clinic, as you are hearing about the Clinic for Women in San Francisco and Planned Parenthood's and other community clinics and federally qualified centers in San Francisco General Hospital, et cetera. But I think we need to think about what are the barriers to care, and are we all, it's pound foolish sometimes when we think about, okay, we're going to punish people and make it even harder for this access to health care, and yet there are public health ramifications when people don't have those options and very many challenges that women encounter.
And I'd like to add one more thing. I think on the point of job and wages, I think supporting women in moving out of poverty, women who are supporting their whole families and often on low wages, there's also unique opportunities to access healthcare jobs in this growing sector. And that's something at the clinic we're trying to do, is really connect women to jobs, doing outreach into public housing, in supporting women in getting access that they might otherwise not have. And I think that's a really important part of, lifting people out or supporting them and getting themselves out of poverty.
Yeah. I would say one more note here is the whole issue of safe housing and the role of violence in our communities, the role of not having adequately good coverage into your housing and mental health issues that are also made more complicated by not having safe housing in your communities.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that a lot of the discussion in the Medicaid world is really starting to talk about whole person care. And at the same time, you can't throw the healthcare system at the fact that we don't have a fundamental social compact or social safety net for all these other issues. I do want to go back to the issue of workforce, because we have a question here about how do we actually increase graduation rates? This idea that both expanding access to healthcare for particularly underserved communities, communities of color, also represents a potential pipeline for the workforce, right? What needs to be done to increase graduation rates in the educational system to produce more medical professionals and generally staff? I think there are all sorts of job opportunities in the healthcare sector now, particularly those that include women and people of color. Any thoughts about that?
Well, I think one of the things that we're looking at is embedding, as I said, workforce programs into our organization at the Women's Community Clinic. So we're going out into the community and talking to women about the types of careers that are available to them. And there are so many of them, right? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of where the starting point is. And then as women go through the program, they eventually progress to either employment with us at the clinic or at other hospitals or locations. And I think those types of programs, there are programs with promotoras and community health workers around the state, places like Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. And I think those types of models are really exciting.
Yeah, I agree. I think promotora programs are a good way to get people started in this work. But I think, you know, specifically about the question of how to incentivize graduates of medical programs or other types of clinician programs to come and work with rural communities or low-income communities, I think there definitely has to be an emphasis put in helping folks pay for school loans and sort of the general issue, the larger issue of you know, the debt that people go into to get these degrees and to be able to provide, to be, you know, to become professionals and having that sort of ability that, you know, when they go in the community and they go to community health centers where they may not be paid as much as they may in private practice or somewhere else, that they have some kind of support in paying back loans or in sort of increasing their quality of life. I know that that's something that we see is problematic in rural areas where, you know, the sort of cost of living is low, but also, you know, the wages are low and you know, folks have to pay their bills. So that's a big issue. And then I think, you know, as mentioned before, I'll mention it again briefly, the Medi-Cal reimbursement rates. I think many of the people that we see in the state of California who are lower income are Medi-Cal beneficiaries. And the rates that providers are getting, both, you know, private medical providers and clinics, are getting to be able to provide this care is so low that it's just impossible in many situations to do that. And so in the past few years, we've seen a reduction in providers in many rural areas and in other areas, frankly, of the state for this population. And so I think that that's a really, really important issue that needs to be addressed in the budget and in legislation.
I also want to argue for the need for mentoring and the role of academic health centers like UC San Francisco or Stanford or other campuses throughout our state as well as the country, and really getting into community partnerships. At UCSF, for example, we have a science partnership where many of our medical students and residents go into classrooms in the San Francisco Unified School District and start doing experiments with both young women and young men, because I think it's really important to be able to show, especially now that we have more women going into medicine in many of our medical schools, to be able to show role models and young women of color who've been able to go into medicine and who are oftentimes the first in their families to go to college. But the idea of having this pipeline and the vision of success, and that there are people from your community who are being the pioneers and breaking ground. So I want to be sure that we cover the whole continuum from the promotora, community health outreach workers, the ones who are the certified enrollment workers who are getting young people and their families enrolled in health insurance. But also there are many places, whether it's in nursing, physician assistant, nurse practitioners, as well as medicine, pharmacy, dentistry, et cetera, many, many different careers. But I think we need to continue to demonstrate to young people that there are viable alternatives, that there is a reason to continue to be in school. And now with the internet and the ability to have long-distance learning, I think that there's also many opportunities for this. And part of the ACA actually does have funding for primary care training so that we do have the pipeline for having the workforce that we need. And there's a lot of activity, and I know this is sort of a bridge to what you were asking, but there's a lot of efforts now to really look at the whole team of medical care and what is the role of the nurse practitioner? What is the role of the physical therapist? What's the role of the occupational therapist, et cetera? It's not only just driven by the physician, no offense to you, Alice. But just the fact that we need to be thinking about scope of practice and what are the kinds of coordination role that practitioners like physicians can play versus the other members of the team. And that also includes something that oftentimes is called wraparound services. So when a patient has been in the hospital, what happens when that patient leaves? And what kinds of community-based organizations are available to provide the kind of social support, the transportation, the food that the patients need in order to stay out of the hospital? So now that the incentives are beginning to be changed and having people stay out of systems, we need a lot more of the community social network to be able to play an important role.
Absolutely.
I think we also have a big shortage of primary care providers in this country. And family practice docs are paid at such a low rate that really discourages people from pursuing that. And we need to really talk about doing what we've seen happen in some other countries, which is lifting that up and pulling people into that practice. And then I think to what Claire said, really emphasizing people practicing to the top of their scope of practice so that we are really leveraging all of people's skills and that there are residencies for nurse practitioners and physicians, obviously, but really expanding our vision of what a healthcare provider looks like.
Great. Let me just, because of time, go back to an issue that Lupe had talked about, which was the issue of the undocumented. And Claire, you had mentioned the DACA program, but here's some questions from our audience. Can you talk a little about the people left out of the ACA, for example, undocumented immigrants? Are there any options for providing care for undocumented women? But even on a broader level, what are the next steps for addressing or achieving universal health care? You know, this idea of Medicare for all, including the undocumented.
I'll start by saying that, before the ACA and before, all of the changes that happened, immigrants were already some of the most uninsured, so all immigrants, not just undocumented immigrants. And of course, undocumented immigrants are the ones that remain uninsured even after the ACA. And I think some of the options that exist for them are, of course, undocumented immigrants can come to many community health centers, including Planned Parenthood, including the Women's Community Clinic. So that continues to be an option for people in California specifically. I think in California, depending on whether or not an immigrant has a certain medical condition, they might be able to qualify for special Medi-Cal programs. So specifically for women, if there's an undocumented woman who is pregnant, there's a Medi-Cal program in the state of California called Medi-Cal for pregnancy, so they can qualify for that to receive pregnancy care or abortion services. There's also a program in the state of California called the Family Pact program, which covers family planning services. So no pregnancy, but anybody who's able to procreate can get family planning care, contraceptives, tubal ligations, pregnancy tests, and that kind of thing. So there are resources for people in California. And I'll add that there are also community or county programs specific in different counties that cover indigent people, and that those include undocumented folks, mostly when they go to the emergency room, though. So that's I think, problematic. But I think if folks wanted to get primary care, or not primary care, but some preventative care, they can come to places like Planned Parenthood and other community clinics to get that care. So there are some options. I think the sort of picture is a little bit more bleak in other parts of the country. But I think we should still, even despite all of those resources that exist, a lot of folks don't know that they exist and so still don't access care. And I think also, you know, the continuity of care for some of these people, you know, they can't necessarily get a full scope of services that they need if they can only come in for, you know, family planning or pregnancy care. So I think that continues to be a great issue. And, you know, there's legislation at the state level to expand coverage, so expand sort of options for undocumented immigrants to be able to apply for the health insurance exchange and to receive coverage through that, to be able to qualify for Medi-Cal. So you know, there's movement in the state legislature right now to change that, but I think certainly a sort of larger solution, a federal solution, is necessary. And so I think we're taking steps, but we need a larger solution for these communities, because the sort of proportion of people who are still uninsured and the sort of proportion of people as they exist in our communities, you know, continues to be a public health issue.
I mean, I think there's, you know, we're on a journey. We're just starting this journey, right? So there are a lot of things that can be improved and enhanced, and things that have been set in motion by the ACA. I think some of the really important things are the coverage for undocumented immigrants. We're lifting awareness so that the folks who are not yet insured can get insured, and dealing with issues of affordability. And for those remaining folks who still don't feel like they can afford their premiums, how can we make sure that they get covered under the exchange and or, of course, Medicaid? And then I think some of the other things that we haven't talked about as much, like payment reform, thinking about how we are we're paid in the healthcare system that really is rewarding quantity and not quality. And we're seeing some really exciting shifts in those directions, as well as state-funded innovation projects in places like Oregon that are just really shifting the paradigm of how we deliver care, how we pay for care. When we think about care delivery, we've talked today a lot about the consumer, but there are so many other elements to care that are hidden behind the scenes that we need to pay attention to. And, you know, when we talk about something called the triple aim, right, and that's really big in the world of healthcare right now, it's the focus on the patient experience, the focus on population health and really working from good data and good information, and then, of course, the cost of care. And so we really have to, like, embrace all of these things and just keep working really hard.
I want to say that, you know, getting back to the issue of immigration and other populations that are left out, again, we need to think about the social contract. And these are workers among us who, you know, help us to get the food, the wonderful vegetables and fruits that are on our tables, and we need to think about what's their health status and how do we assure that a healthy population lives among us, because, again, we all bear the brunt if that doesn't happen. I want to point out that special populations, for example, foster care youth, who often are really at very high risk in the past when they turned 18, would no longer be eligible if they were Medicaid eligible before that age. And one of the positive aspects of ACA has been now that foster care youth can stay in that in the program, in their Medicaid program, because they often qualify up to age 26. There's also been a major effort to try to get young men and men of other ages. I know tonight we have really put the lens on women, but I think it's important to explain that previously men were not eligible to receive services if they weren't pregnant. And now through the Medicaid program, if they're low income, they're eligible. And again, women carry that burden if their partners are not covered by health insurance. And prisoners, I think, are another very important population, and there are many community-based programs that are working with the prison system so that as prisoners leave the system, that there is a safety net available to them, because, again, what are the costs of prisons that we all bear, and yet if we had a healthier group, again, that might be some cost savings. And I think another point that I just want to make here that we have to touch on is the role of the electronic healthcare record. In terms of having that more available, avoiding the type of fragmentation, avoiding duplication of tests, putting patients at risk, you know, by having too many tests that are unnecessary, and beginning to talk about the level of coordination that's needed across systems. We are a long way from nirvana, but again, this is a building block, this is a step, this is part of the journey that has been mentioned here, and we need to be keeping progress on that road.
So I have three different directions I could go in, and time is running out. But I'm going to pick up on this idea of equity and hidden costs and ask you about mental health services, just because we touched upon it briefly in the essential health benefits. But I think a lot of people probably don't realize how much disparity there was between physical and mental health. I mean, up until last year, you know, there were disparities in terms of Medicare co-payments. Originally, it was 20% out-of-pocket versus 50% for mental health. And so this is an issue that definitely affects women. Can you talk a little bit about the benefits of ACA vis-a-vis mental health?
Yeah. Well, I think we're really seeing this happen in San Francisco just as one example of what's happening nationwide, which is that mental health is now an inclusion in mm-hmm. Medicaid. So with San Francisco Health Plan, our local provider, one of our local providers of Medi-Cal, we have been able to bring in mental health services to our clinics, which is hugely exciting. Mm-hmm. So women can get treated when they want, how much they want. Whereas before, there was a long waiting list. It was extremely difficult to get into care. You know, that's a shift. It's going to take time, and it's still happening. But I think we're on an exciting journey, and we've really been able to see the benefit of providing mental health services to our patients, again, so that they don't fragment their care, but also because their mental health impacts all other aspects of their life, their health wholly conceived, as opposed to just piecing things mm-hmm. up. It's really all so tied together, which I think is no secret to the folks in the audience.
I'll just add that Planned Parenthood is doing the same kind of thing, and I think many community clinics across the state are doing that because of the ACA, so sort of integrating mental health services with all of the other care that's being provided and sort of, again, providing this idea of a medical home where people can get all of their services and needs met. And again, I'll just echo again that I think mental health is a very important part of not just reproductive health care, although it is a big part of that, but every other sort of health outcome is dependent on that in a lot of ways. And so I think that's a really good new thing that's happening.
Okay. And this isn't just among low-income populations. So there's been one study that has been focused on the young adults who have been covered now under their parents' plans, private plans, up to age 26. And approximately about 2 to 5 million young adults, a large number of those being young women. And when they looked at the first billing data and they started analyzing how are these young people using the healthcare system, about 42% of those billings were for mental health services. Mm-hmm. So even among, quote unquote, even among middle-class families that might have access to mental health services through other means, it wasn't until their young adults had this type of coverage that they were able to access the kind of mental health. And we know that during the young adulthood is when some of the most major mental health issues truly emerge, which has consequences not only during that young adult period, but throughout the life course.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's only time for one last question. I think you'll agree with me that our panelists have touched upon a really broad range of the impact of ACA. So I'm going to ask you, this is actually an audience question, in 10 years, what is the most exciting change we can expect to see as a result from the ACA? A different crystal ball than mm-hmm. King versus Burwell? A better one, hopefully?
Right. Yeah.
But what do you see in 10 years as the best outcome?
Do you want to start, Lupe?
Sure. You know, I hope, and I want to sort of really think about that crystal ball and hope that it comes true, that I think we want to see everybody covered in the state of California and in the country, so including our undocumented community members. I think we also want to see that maternal mortality, that contraception, and that other types of reproductive health care is fully covered and completely accessible to anybody who wants it. And that a lot of the sort of issues that aren't fixed by health insurance, you know, just solely the idea of now having health insurance, like issues that we mentioned about infrastructure, poverty, and things like that are alleviated so that we really have a wholly healthy society.
I think, first of all, I would love to see all those states that are not expanding Medicaid jump on board. I'm hoping by then they will have decided to do so. I think also I imagine our healthcare system, and I hope it to look extremely different than it looks today. I hope that the way that we pay for care is different. I hope that we know a lot more about the people that we serve, and in terms of what we've been able to find out about them through our electronic health records and other systems, so that we are better able to serve them with the care they need when they need it and the type of care. I hope that we've expanded coverage to all of our residents here in the United States. And I hope all the states have their own wonderfully thriving exchanges. Probably my list could get much longer, but I'll stop there.
Well, I'll say ditto to my dear colleagues, but I would also say that I think we should really think about the value, and we should think about healthcare outcomes and what's quality. One last pitch, I think, would be for a little bit of patience. This is really revolutionary. This is really not just Rome being built in a day. And I worry sometimes about the American public being very impatient and wanting to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We need to understand that this will take a very active population. So I'd like to see patient engagement and consumer engagement playing a very important role in shaping healthcare delivery.
Our thanks to the California Wellness Foundation for underwriting this program and to our panelists, Carlina Hansen, Executive Director for the Women's Community Clinic in San Francisco, Dr. Claire Brindis, Director of the UCSF Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies, and Lupe Rodriguez, Director of Public Affairs for Planned Parenthood Marmonte. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio and internet. I'm Dr. Alice Chen, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.